Hi, welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, your monthly potpourri of literary snacks for the mind and interviews. And I'm Sandy Harper, here with my co-host Dick Reichman. And this month is particularly appropriate for our special guest because his life has been one of service, collaboration, and partnerships. We welcome to our program Dennis McMillan, the CEO of 4-Acre.
Hi. Thanks, Sandy.
Hi, Dennis.
And Dick, welcome.
It's good to be here.
Well, it's lovely to have you. And maybe you, to start off, tell us a little bit about what 4-Acre is and how it came to be.
Well, 4-Acre is a nonprofit whose purpose in life is to help nonprofits become more strategic and sustainable. And we started actually 8 years ago this month. So a lot of time has passed since we had this idea and started on this journey. But we're now serving nonprofits and tribes throughout the state of Alaska, actually more organizations outside of the Anchorage area than in Anchorage. Even though a majority of the nonprofits in Alaska are in Anchorage, we're disproportionately serving folks around the state. And we have three basic areas of service. One is the original concept was to have a shared service component, which means organizations that are small oftentimes don't have technical expertise on their staff to deal with certain issues like human resources or finance. And our original idea was to have people that were very competent working with us who could do that kind of service for nonprofits that were medium or small, and they didn't have a full-time staff member that was a finance person or a full-time person dealing with human resources. But if they had a human resource issue, then they could just call us up, and then we would have somebody that understood nonprofits and
sort
could go help them.
Sort of a clearinghouse support service for everybody.
Exactly. So we have a number of our organizations that we work with that are having shared financials or web design or human resource management. And so that's one whole area of 4-Acre. And then another major area is around training. And we have training for staff members. We have training for board members. And some of this is very informal, where we have a lot of classes, almost 30 classes just for board members on how to be on a board, different things, fundraising or planning or finance, how to read financials. And we have another 20 classes that are really geared for staff members, like how to do business planning or how to do fundraising plans. And then we have some very formal training. We have a certificate through the University of Alaska. For 13 days, people now come in and have all the basics they need to know about how to be a CEO of a nonprofit. And we've been doing that now for 7 years. We've had 140 graduates from throughout the state. And then we also have a degree program through Alaska Pacific University, through their Rural Alaska Native Adult program, where individuals can get a bachelor's degree in business with a nonprofit emphasis. And we've been engaged in that now for about 7 years also. So lots of different kinds of training for folks in Alaska that are engaged in the nonprofit sector. And then finally, we do under a broad category of organizational development, one-on-one work with nonprofits where we'll do a board retreat or we'll help with the strategic plan of an organization. Or we'll go in if there's some sort of chaos going on inside the organization. We're having an independent person come in to negotiate, mediate, helps. And so those are the three basic areas that 4-Acre works in.
Dennis, at the beginning of your talk, you mentioned something about that keyword sustainability. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could say more about that, because it's a concept that maybe people who don't work in nonprofits think much about, and it's such a key to the survival of social service.
It is. And, Dick, that's a great question. And when 4-Acre started, it had this notion of trying to create sustainable organizations because it was almost like it's cachet. I mean, everybody talked about sustainability. But when we actually sat down and looked at research on nonprofit sustainability, we were shocked at how little had been written and what people actually knew. And for the most part, people only talked about money. They talked about, well, having enough income in order to operate. And while we think that's one factor organizations need to think about when it comes to sustainability, it's just one of the factors. And so we've identified four areas that we think influence sustainability. The first is having the right people engaged in the organization. And any nonprofit has to have a board. All the research on nonprofit effectiveness says that it's about the board, that you can have really effective staff working in a nonprofit, but if you don't have an effective board, you're not going to be as sustainable because staff come and staff go, as do board. But the board is an institution, and that board and the collective knowledge of a board, if done the right way, can help an organization become more sustainable. So having a board and having the right people on the board and having the board do what a board does is critical to sustainability. But it's not just about the board. We also don't know of very many situations where a nonprofit is what we would consider sustainable if it doesn't have a paid staff. That there really is a need for someone to turn on the lights and make the coffee, as well as everything else that staff does in a nonprofit, that in a partnership with the board, create an environment of sustainability. So it's a good staff, it's a good board working in a partnership, which sounds pretty easy on the surface, but it's about as easy as any kind of human relationship, which, of course, is not very easy. Finding the right people and then maintaining the right people is a journey. It's not necessarily a goal because I don't know that we ever quite get there. I think it's always – there are always challenges.
Dennis, does that force the focus to be on fundraising and underwriting the organization and away from the programs and values sometimes?
No. About having the right people?
No. Having to support something financially.
Well, I'm going to get to that one because one of the other factors.
Okay.
I mean, the first factor is people. You have to have the right people to do anything, to do fundraising, to do program, to do mission, to do anything. The second factor we think has to do with being collaborative is that as a sector, we talk a lot about collaboration. We talk a lot about working together. However, nonprofits oftentimes are fiercely competitive with each other. And sometimes that's okay. You could have a group that's pro-development that's a nonprofit, and you could have a group that's pro-non-development that's a nonprofit, and they're obviously not going to work together because their missions collide. But where you have organizations that have complementary missions or missions where they could be collaborative, we think it's inherent that nonprofits work together to make that happen because none of us can do everything. We all need partners to be successful, whether they're for-profit or nonprofit. And nonprofits oftentimes look inward more than outward to solve problems. And so finding partners in the community to help you succeed is a critical factor, we think, towards sustainability. The third factor is staying focused. Because many nonprofits are created by individuals who have a lot of vision and desire to help and to have an impact, many nonprofits suffer from what we call mission drift. They create themselves to do something, but as they start doing it, then they find something else that they want to do, then something else that they want to do, then something else that they want to do. And before long, they're so distracted by all the different things that they're doing, they're not doing what they were founded to do. So having the focus to stay disciplined and stay focused on the mission and not let the mission get too broad is another factor of sustainability because too many nonprofits lose that focus and then their whole energy starts to wane.
So these issues pertain to all nonprofits? I mean, they're all different.
Nonprofits, whether we're talking environmental arts.
There's political groups. There's environmental groups. They're all the same generically, huh?
Exactly. I mean, there are some absolute differences in income stream and staffing and, in the feel of an organization based on whether they're an environmental group or an arts group or a human service group. But nonprofits are nonprofits, and these four factors that we've identified go across any kind of nonprofit. The final factor is money, Sandy, mm-hmm. and it's finding the right kind of income, the right mix of income. And out of all the nonprofits in Alaska, about two-thirds, almost three-quarters are charitable nonprofits, what are called 501c3 in IRS code nonprofits. And those are the kinds of organizations like Cyrano's that are charitable organizations. They have a charitable mission, and arts is a charitable mission, as is education, as is human service. Mm-hmm. And those organizations are what most people think of when they think of nonprofits, is they think about something like an arts organization or a human service organization or an educational institution. Those organizations have a number of different income stream potentials. One is they can generate revenue based on their mission. We call it earned revenue, just like in a for-profit business. So in an arts organization, it could be ticket sales. It could be entrance fees. It could be advertising for shows. It could be all sorts of things where people pay you a fee for a service that you're providing based on your mission. 4-Acre Group gets paid to work with nonprofits by nonprofits, and that's how we generate revenue. So earned revenue is a good revenue for nonprofits as long as it's related to the mission. If a nonprofit tries to generate earned revenue from something that's not at all related to who they are, what their mission's about, then they may have to pay tax on that just like any other business would pay tax if they generated that income. But earned revenue's good, and you have to be entrepreneurial, and you also have to be disciplined just like a business when you're generating earned revenue. The problem with most nonprofits and earned revenue is that we never charge what we're worth. Therefore, there's a gap between what it costs to do what we do and what people are paying us to do it. So that gap is oftentimes filled with a variety of sources. Too many nonprofits in Alaska have filled that gap with grants. And grants, whether they come from a corporation or a foundation or the government, are not sustainable. Most of those kinds of funders, government, foundations, and businesses, only want to fund once. They don't want to fund you year after year after year. And if you're an arts organization, you can sometimes get a corporation to do support on an annual basis, but it's for a new project or a museum for a new exhibit. But organizations that don't have something new tend to lose the favor of institutional givers like foundations and corporations.
Why is that, Dennis? Why wouldn't a major donor like a corporation want to give operating money to some organization that they feel is benefiting the community where their workers live?
Dick, you've already asked two incredibly good questions, so you're almost at your limit. I'm sorry.
Cut me off.
Okay, I have to cut you off. I'll have a hard time if you ask me another hard one. We don't know why it is that necessarily that foundations and corporations specifically are not interested in operating funds for nonprofits, other than, you know, operating funds become entitlements in organizations' minds. And, you know, corporations and foundations have limited amounts of money that they give away. Corporations based on some sort of internal values of the corporation toward community support. Foundations are typically limiting themselves to 5% of their savings account. They'll use interest earned off of their savings account to invest in nonprofits. And if they do too much annual giving, sustainable funding for operations, then they have no money for new things. And so that's the only reason that we know of. But I think another way to throw this on its side is to understand that out of all philanthropy in America, how insignificant corporate giving and foundation giving is. Because if you look at those two sources of revenue, and philanthropy is individual giving, corporate giving, and foundation giving. Those are the three components of philanthropy, what's called philanthropy. And if you look at corporate giving and foundation giving, it represents 17% of the total.
Both together represent 17%?
Yep. So therefore...
So individuals are always the ones that have supported, that are the philanthropic force around the country.
But lots of people are not in the habit of exactly. philanthropy.
That, isn't that a fun word to try? In Alaska specifically, we commissioned a study with Institute for Social and Economic Research, ICER, last year. And we've had hunches about some of this stuff before, but they were actually able to quantify better than anybody has to date the situation here in Alaska. And nationally, philanthropy is 83% supported by individuals. In Alaska, it's maybe 60%. So corporate giving here and foundation giving here is significantly higher than it is in the lower 48. Part of that has to do with the type of business mix that we have. Having a major foundation like the Rasmussen Foundation, or having, nationally corporate giving is now 5% of philanthropy. If you take every corporate gift in America, not their employees, but just the corporate giving in America, it's only 5% of total philanthropy. However, in Alaska, BP corporate giving is 5% of total philanthropy, and ConocoPhillips is slightly more than 5% of total philanthropy in Alaska. So we have two companies that each exceed by themselves the national norm. So we have incredible generosity from a few. And we have some challenges for the many. Mm-hmm. And we have to grow individual giving in Alaska. And it's one of the reasons that 4-Acre Group partnered with the Rasmussen Foundation and the United Way of Anchorage and many others to promote the Pick, Click, Give initiative that many of you are now aware of, where individuals, as they do their online application for their permanent fund dividend, will be able to make a charitable contribution with a part of their permanent fund dividend to organizations that went through a process at the state of approval, and over 300 nonprofits around the state. That is one of our attempts to start asking individuals to give more, because it is going to be the only way that many nonprofits in Alaska survive into the future. Because going back to sustainability, there are only two sustainable revenue streams. One is generating earned revenue, so whatever you're doing that's related to your mission that you can charge a fee for. And the other is individual giving. Done the right way. And every other kind of funding that nonprofits go after is really not sustainable. And in Alaska, we're way too dependent on the non-sustainable streams and not on the sustainable.
Well, I do think that people who are generous in giving to nonprofits have to be kind of reassured that they're helping with giving fishing poles and not a continuous supply of fish. I think that is true, and that is where 4-Acre is very helpful in helping nonprofits.
Well, we want nonprofits to – I mean, people that are generous and most people are generous.
I think they are.
Want to give. I mean, they like to give. They understand that giving is good for the soul. It's good for the community. It's good on a lot of different levels to give. And we all have different capacities to give depending on our stage in life, depending on our income. Depending on our own perception of our capacity to give, which sometimes is cultural or a family tradition. But people typically want to invest their charitable dollars into organizations that touch their heart and that they see as being effective at what they do and competent at what they do. Back in the fall, when the economy started to tank, our friends here at KSKA, along with all the other public radio stations in the state, were doing their fall pledge drive. And so I called a number of the larger stations, K2 and KNBA and KSKA here, and said, okay, how's it going for you? Because you've got all this bad publicity about the economy. Well, the public station in Juneau had a 25% increase in giving.
Increase?
In this past fall. This station, KSKA, had almost a 20% increase in giving. So people, individual givers, don't seem to give less as a result of economy. If anything, people give more when they perceive the economy is not doing well. And that has been the experience now for as many years as people have been tracking charitable giving in America.
So it's not just a matter, Dennis McMillan, of the recession not really having made us broke yet.
Exactly. Well, I mean, if we're broke and we can't give. And there are individuals that perceive themselves to be broke, and therefore they are not going to give or not give as much as they have in the past. But individual donors are the most resilient. Individual donors are the most consistent. And when nonprofits do a good job of connecting their support to the mission, the individual support to their mission, like KSKA does, when times get hard, people don't think twice about continuing to give.
So what's your advice to small nonprofit organizations as we head into what appears to be a major long-lasting recession?
Well, if you already have a group of committed individual donors, then you will have a lot easier time of surviving what's going to happen in the next few years than those organizations that have never tried to cultivate individual contributions. Also, if the organization has a significant amount of earned revenue, they also will tend to be more resilient than organizations that got grant money from corporations because, you know, when corporations make a lot of profits, they have more money for corporate giving. And we're going to go through a period where corporations are not going to have as much money, and so they'll give less. Foundations give based on how much money they have in their savings
in
account and their corpus and then on the market. And so in times like this, when many foundations have had a significant cutback in how much money they actually have, they'll have less money to give away.
Because they're giving a percentage of their total holdings, which has been severely reduced lately.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So and then we haven't talked about maybe the other big issue that's going to impact Alaska's nonprofits. And when we talk about philanthropy and the charitable giving, nationally, that only represents 25% of the budgets of the nonprofits. 40% is coming from earned revenue, ticket sales, that kind of thing. 35% comes from government grants and contracts. That's the national norm. 25% philanthropy, corporate giving, foundation giving, individual giving, 35% government, and 40% earned revenue. Well, in Alaska, we get a little less than 40% from earned revenue, so we have a little bit of growth there. But we're only getting 9% from philanthropy in Alaska. So our philanthropic mix of the pie is a lot less than it is around the country. But here's the zinger, is that we are 57% supported by government grants and contracts as compared to the national norm of 35%. People have often wondered what was the impact of our delegation in the past and the kind of money that was brought in, especially from Washington, D.C. to the state. Well, to the nonprofit sector, it was the biggest part of our funding. And if history teaches us anything, we know that when long-lived, strong delegations change over in Washington, that the states also lose out on some of the resources that they once enjoyed. And even if we were to double philanthropy in Alaska next year, chances are we were going to have significantly less money because of this federal cutback. And also, you know, with oil being below $40 mm-hmm. a barrel, you know, the state also is going to have to be a bit more strident in its looking at supporting what's going on So we're in for some interesting times, some hard times. There are going to be some nonprofits that survive through all this. There are going to be others who are going to struggle. But what the 4-Acre Group does is we work with them all, whether they're have done all the right things or done some of the right things. Our job is to help the boards and the staffs figure out what's the best strategy for them at this point and try to help them move there.
Are you funded as the 4-Acre Group in a similar way to these organizations you've described?
We generate 80% of our revenue from earned sources, where organizations, either little nonprofits or big nonprofits, or funders like the Rasmussen Foundation or BP or Conoco or Mental Health Trust, give us money to provide services on their behalf. So 80% of our revenue comes that way. And we do generate 20% of our revenue from support, from contributions. But it's a pretty small percentage of our budget.
Yeah, I'm curious about the whole genesis and history of the 4-Acre Fund. Isn't that unique in Alaska, or is it?
It is in some ways. I mean, there are organizations, they're called capacity building organizations or management assistance organizations. In a lot of the states, it's known as a nonprofit association, so like the Alaska Nonprofit Association. And that's really what we are. We're like an association of nonprofits, and we provide services to our members. We have members that pay an annual fee to be part of the 4-Acre Group. And we started with this little idea that grew once Elmer Rasmussen heard the idea, and he and all of the good people at the Rasmussen Foundation, as well as many of the other major institutional funders in the state, heard this idea and grew it. But now we're the largest of our kind in the country by far, and have more complex programs, which astounds me, because we still don't really know what we're doing. We're still learning this business because it's a new business, and so we're unique.
Do you remember the day you walked into Elmer Rasmussen's office and presented this idea?
I do. It was a very interesting day. I had been with Diane Kaplan and Ed Rasmussen, who had said that Elmer was saying something about the United Good Neighbors Fund. And at the time, I was still at the United Way. And they says, well, you really need to meet Dennis, who runs the United Way. But you're only going to get – when Diane says, you know, Elmer's getting about – he's about 90, and his you know, he's going to give you 15 minutes, but if you see that he's starting to lose interest, you may want to get up earlier than that so you don't overstay your welcome. Well, 2.5 hours later, we were still talking. He was very interested in what the United Way was doing, and one of those was this concept of a shared service for nonprofits. And then he took it and said it needs to be bigger, it needs to be statewide. And he was thinking strategically about how the Rasmussen Foundation was gearing up and how this would be really beneficial to them if something like this happened in Alaska.
And it was definitely a major springboard to the reality of the 4-Acre.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry we don't have more time, Dennis. There's a lot more I'd love to talk about with you, but maybe you can come back and visit us another time.
I would be happy to.
And in the meantime, we hope everyone out there in Radio Land joins us again next month for another episode of the Alaska Radio Reader Rambler.